It's the budget-busting edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, feathered terror, Trumping anti-vax, Passover mythology, and skeptical concerns about the budget. Let's begin episode 161.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The
cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. So, Ethan, I understand that scientists have been scared out of their wits by feathers.
That's right. This is a really cool science story, but unfortunately, another example of a very poorly worded headline. So I'll read you the actual headline and then we can discuss. So here it is. Huge feathered Tyrannosaurus surprises researchers. Now, I don't know about you, but when I read this, this implied to me that a huge feathered Tyrannosaurus broke into a lab and surprised some scientists. I was disappointed to learn that no, that's not what happened actually.
You mean it wasn't like Jurassic Park, you know, for real? I mean, we have all been dying to see that, but you're telling me that it's not as interesting as that?
No, in fact, I don't even think these scientists were that surprised because there appears to be a wealth of scientific evidence that implies that dinosaurs had feathers. I don't know. This is very poorly worded. I don't think these scientists were surprised at all. I think they were probably expecting to find something like this in the fossil record.
So tell me, fossils and feathers are not a new thing, right? I mean, there's obviously Archaeopteryx, which we've known about for a long time. But quite recently, we've seen other dinosaurs that have feathers.
Well, right. And this is a pretty cool find. This is a new species of Tyrannosaur, which grew to a length of 9 meters and weighed 1,400 kilograms. It lived in northeastern China about 125 million years ago during the early Cretaceous period. And this is all in a paper published by Chinese and Canadian researchers in Nature. This came out on Wednesday. This is the largest creature ever found that has feathers. And these feathers, which were long and hair-like, sort of like the feathers on a baby chick, were probably designed for keeping this animal warm during the rather cold period of the early Cretaceous. The dinosaur in question is named Yatranus huli. I'm probably saying that wrong, but it means beautiful feathered tyrant, which I'm sure is probably the first time those words have been put together ever. It's a combination of Latin and Mandarin, because this was found in China after all, and this is 40 times more massive than the largest feathered dinosaur known before, which was Bapeosaurus. So this is a relative of the Tyrannosaurus rex, who appeared much later on in the fossil record, because the T-Rex, as we commonly refer to it, had patches of scaly skin. But as I said, they lived about 50 million years later during the late Cretaceous when the temperatures were much warmer. So this does lend a lot of evidence to the idea that dinosaurs with fossil or dinosaurs that had feathers probably didn't have them to fly or anything like that. They had them because it was a way to stay warm and a much colder environment than the later Cretaceous period where, you know, we have the famous T-Rex that probably looked a lot like it did in Jurassic Park.
But Ethan, I mean, I've studied my intelligent design and I know things like flight and the feather is like perfect and irreducible complexity. Are you telling me that feathers may have evolved first for something that has nothing to do with flight and then later on became more specialized to allow flight?
I don't want to blow your mind, but yes, that's exactly what I'm suggesting. In fact, Some of the fossils that they found of this dinosaur, they've actually got three nearly complete skeletons, an adult, a subadult, and a juvenile, indicate that, in fact, the feathers may have served some interesting functions in the Waiholi interactions, including they may have been using them as mating rituals. The males appeared to have sort of big crests, sort of like a robin does. And they may have used these to attract females or use them in some kind of social structure. Perhaps they were group hunters. We don't know exactly, but it's really quite fascinating. It gives us so much more insight into what these creatures did in their daily lives and how they interacted with each other. So incredibly fascinating. And also, I mean, really cool science story. I mean, who doesn't love dinosaurs? And now they have feathers. I mean, this is just awesome.
Exactly, you know, and we sit back and everyone says, you know, well, show me evolution at work. I mean, at least a creationist intelligent design. And here again, we have another win to say, look, here it is. And not only is it here, but it's like in such a fantastic sort of motif. I mean, as you say, yeah. How cool to think about, you know, dinosaurs going across the savannas of its time, all feathered. I'm just cool.
Yeah. And it's great. It's a great example of how science works, because early on, the theory of feathered dinosaurs isn't exactly new. I mean, it was sort of floating around possibly as early as the Origin of the Species was, but there wasn't really a fossil record to substantiate any of those claims. It wasn't until the 1990s when they started to find these dinosaur bones that, all of a sudden, you know, now we have physical evidence that goes along with a lot of sort of the theoretical ideas that maybe there were dinosaurs with feathers as well. And it's also kind of neat that they came from sort of the same area, this Liang province in China, and that's probably because of sort of the unique area. It was, covered by a volcano and ash, but sort of preserved a lot of these finds, so that we've been finding a lot of different dinosaurs and even, you know, mammals and frogs and salamanders and crocodiles and all these kind of things. And it's just been really exciting because, you know, here's an area that has been so well preserved, but allows us to find the added things like the feathers and learn a bit more about these animals, which is not to imply that all the feathered dinosaurs lived in this part of China, but only that this part of China has the environment to preserve these fossils for us to find them.
Well, isn't that one of the crapshoots, though, of paleontology in itself? Is, as you point out, we can't necessarily imply that all feathered dinosaurs existed in this one area. But, I mean, this area could have been sort of the Australia of its time, where evolutionary branches went wild. And maybe this is the origin of birds. I mean, that's the other thing I like about this, is it strengthens the connection between dinosaurs and birds, which, again, when everyone says the dinosaurs went extinct at the KT event, then we get to say, no, see that bird? It's really a dinosaur, or at least a relative of a dinosaur.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well, again, the idea that we're... That everything is related. I mean, after all, right? Like you, me, everybody, we all have some genetic...
Ethan, no, I know my parents, I know my grandparents, I know my grandparents. We are not related.
Hey, we should get a DNA test. I'm sure that if we go back farther enough, we're probably like, you know, eighth cousins or something like that. But the point being is we're related to all life forms on this planet and they're related to us. So, I mean, it's kind of... It's important to keep that in mind, right? I mean... Sure, we go back far enough, we'll find out that crocodiles and birds and humans and mice all share common ancestry. And so this is just another way of tracing that ancestry back and finding out where two species diverged. And again, fascinating stuff. Great science story. I love to see dinosaur stuff in the news because it gets people's attention. And that's a great thing for science.
Speaking of dinosaurs in the news and people I do not want to be related to, after we come back from this commercial... We are going to talk about someone who is trumpeting the anti-vax agenda.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker here on CITR. So as Don hinted at before the break, here is... another dinosaur in the news, I guess that's a good way of putting it. That is Donald Trump of the You're Fired fame. It turns out that the Donald is an anti-vaxxer, which I guess is not terribly surprising after all when you think about it.
No, not at all. In fact, I love his reasoning as to why he's become an anti-vaxxer is so classic. I mean, remember, this is Donald Trump who for like 2 or 3 minutes thought he could get some extra press by becoming a GOP intended nominee for president. And during that time announced that he was a birther and sort of blew his campaign out of the water then. But I mean, you've read the news article where he comes out and says, this is why I am supporting the anti-vax movement.
That's right. And since then, he's been written up by different blogs. You know, Steve Novella and Orac have both written about this. And you can sort of look at what Trump is basically saying here. And it's not unique. It's not anything special. He's basically just rehashing a lot of the same anti-vax propaganda that's been out there for the past years now. And, you know, he goes on about you know, vaccinations. He says, oh, I'm a fan of vaccinations. They do good things. But you're giving, you know, kids who are too young, you're giving them too many vaccinations. You're giving them these, they're full of, you know, horrible things.
Well, no, Ethan, let's break it down because we have one of his quotes right here. And I think we can almost do it section by section and sort of show where he's kind of gone off the rail.
Yeah,
so this
absolutely.
Is actually from Steve Novella's Neurological where he's quoting, and I'm going to assume this quote is correct because I have seen this in other blog posts. But line one, I've gotten pretty familiar with the subject. You know, I have a theory, and it's a theory that some people believe in, and it's that vaccinations, we've never had anything like this. This is now an epidemic. Okay, so first of all, he has a theory, right? And some people believe in it. Well, some people, again, believe the earth is flat. It's not that you come up with some theory and that somehow makes it true. It's the fact that there's scientific evidence that leads to a hypothesis that in turn has support from the evidence, that becomes the theory, not like, oh, well, it's conceivable that this could happen this way.
Yeah, and the way that he prefaces that by saying, I've gotten to be pretty familiar with the subject. Well, if you have to first state that you're an expert so that someone will believe you, that's not a very good way to open your argument. If you know what you're talking about, that should come across in how you discuss it. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to say, oh, by the way, I'm also an expert on this as well. That's a red flag right there.
It's also interesting, too, in how he became familiar with the subject. I mean, anyone who does a Google search will find so much crap that's put out there by the anti-vax movement. It's astonishing. And if he's basing all his beliefs on this, as opposed to using the evidence, then, I mean, maybe you can see why he'd do this. Then he goes on, he says right after that part, quote, it's way up over the past 10 years. It's way up over the past 2 years. So, again, he's saying, well, there's sort of this epidemic, right? He mentioned that word epidemic. Well, part of the reason why there's an epidemic in autism is because our diagnosis of it has increased. Now considered a spectrum, a lot of diagnoses were not seen as autistic if you go back a number of years, but now are seen as autistic, which makes the numbers seem to balloon. There's also the sort of cruel fact that if you have a child that's not doing well in school and you get that child diagnosed in the autism spectrum, so they get that extra teacher, they get that extra funding to help them become a better student. So again, saying that the numbers are way up in and of itself is a false flag.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a very common argument they make, and it totally discounts all the notions that indicate that our ability to diagnose any condition, whether it's autism or anything, is up. Doesn't mean that we're seeing more cases. It means that we're getting better at spotting them. And then, of course, he goes into that sort of notion of too many vaccinations before a child is developed, which kind of ties into this notion that we're sort of overwhelming the immune system, that we're causing too much damage. And again, it's just that's not how the immune system works. And that's not how vaccinations work either. So, I mean, he clearly doesn't understand the science behind this. And he's going on a lot of these sort of nonsense talking points that we see in the anti-vax movement. And then if you look at some of the other quotes that he's made about his sort of knowledge about this sort of thing, he even brings up an example where he says, it happened to someone that worked for me recently. He added, I mean, they had this beautiful child, not a problem in the world. And all of a sudden they go and they get this monster shot. You ever see the size of it? It's like they're pumping in, you know, it's terrible, the amount. And they pump it this into the little body, and then all of a sudden the child's different a month later. I strongly believe that's it. Well, I mean, he's got an anecdote, and he uses these sort of loaded emotional terms, this monster shot. I mean, he's clearly embracing this conspiracy. And as we know, I mean, the more you embrace a conspiracy, the more that you sort of draw a line in the sand, you become increasingly difficult to remove yourself from that conspiracy. And everything becomes to be interpreted through the lens of that conspiracy theory. I mean, this is very easy to get suckered into.
But just before you go too far, just to point out his logical fallacy, most people have car accidents after having coffee. Therefore, coffee causes car accidents. I mean, again, correlation and causation error. But you're right. Creating this conspiracy, and then once you've bought into that conspiracy, comes a whole other level of denialism.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point. I mean, the correlation causation, I mean, that's, again, one of those things that people will mix up very often. So, again, not surprising coming from Donald Trump. Disappointing in the fact that he does have a louder voice than most people. And but again, I'm kind of hopeful that, I mean, Donald Trump is not necessarily considered a sort of a paragon of rational thought either. So in an odd sort of way, this may actually hurt the anti-vax movement by having another kind of crank attached to it. But we'll have to see for sure what happens.
True. And speaking of propagating myths, when we come back from this commercial, we're going to talk about a timely myth that may have passed over us.
As interesting as listening to this PSA is, there's nothing quite like watching it. Watching what, you ask? The annual showcase of films that accompany it as part of the POV, or Persistence of Vision, Film Festival. This showcase of short films written, directed, shot, edited, and produced by students in the film production program at UBC happens only once a year. On April 27th and 28th, join the POV Festival at the Empire Granville 7 Cinemas in the heart of downtown Vancouver as these magnificent films are debuted. For tickets and information, visit povfilmfestival.com.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, any plans for the long weekend? Are you going to be hunting for Easter eggs, perhaps?
I had no plans for the long weekend, but I did thought I'd hunt me up some myths. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Passover. We have done this before. I think we did it like actually 2 years ago. And so it's that time of year. But South Park had an interesting episode based upon Passover, so I thought, let's just take a skeptical look. So, of course, one of the things that's always assumed is the pyramids were built by Jewish slaves. Now, of course, there's no archaeological evidence that's shown that they did this. In fact, what evidence we do have shows that they weren't built by any kind of slave, but actually the job of pyramid builder was considered one, a holy one, and those people were treated with a lot of respect. In the 90s, they've done a lot of excavating of the sort of work camp that built the pyramids. And again, they had a pretty sweet life, relatively speaking. I mean, everyone worked hard back then. But these people were involved in a holy task.
Yeah. And in fact, evidence has shown that they were treated very well. Like, they got meat, which is obviously kind of a rarity back in those times. They got sizable quarters. They were sort of given a lot of respect from the community around them. So I think the notion of them being slaves is really misinterpreting the information here.
You know, yeah. And of course, you know, in fact, there is no evidence actually that there were any Jews in Egypt until about 2,000 years after the pyramids were built. I mean, a lot of people think the pyramids were built around the same time that the Romans were there or something close to that. But they actually started building them in about 2500 BCE. And they've finished, the last pyramid was built around 1750 BCE, which is, again, 2,000 years before there's any evidence of there being any sort of Jews in Israel. In fact, Israel itself didn't come into existence until about a millennium after the pyramids were built.
That's right. And I mean, the funny thing is, too, at least from our understanding of history, was that Egypt was perceived as being one of the oldest civilizations in the Mediterranean. And a lot of other civilizations and cultures really tried to sort of emulate Egypt. I mean, you talk about the Romans and the Greeks and the other civilizations around them. There was this really sort of intense kind of reverence for sort of ancient Egypt. And, you know, even the gods of Egypt are considered to be very old, very powerful gods. So, I mean, definitely the pyramids predate a lot of the so-called history that we see in the Bible.
And, you know, ironically enough, you know, as much as we might want to say, oh, well, this is all part of Israel and the Jews to sort of build themselves up by contrasting themselves with Egypt, apparently the whole slave myth has its history in, can you guess, Ethan?
Greek mythology?
Close. Herodotus.
Close enough.
Yes. Who actually wrote that it was built by slaves. And again, I don't think he mentioned Jewish slaves, just it was built by slaves around 450 BCE. Again, well over 1,000 years after the last pyramid was complete. I mean, right now, we have a hell of a time trying to understand what life was like 1,000 years ago with all our modern techniques and writing and stuff. How would he know, except again, by myth and by legend, and his respectability as a, you know, a valued source, or at least an accurate source of information, has really dropped over the last couple of decades.
Oh, well, yeah, even hundreds of years, really. I mean, there's so many problems with trying to interpret his history. I mean, for one thing, he's observing, writing after the fact. I mean, he's being interpreted through multiple versions throughout history, right? And also the problem is, I mean, maybe what he witnessed was different. I mean, look at how society can change in 10 years. I mean, sure, it's completely possible that Egypt had, you know, various despots in power. Sometimes there may have been slaves. Sometimes there may not have been slaves. So, I mean, it's very difficult to determine exactly what did he see and how accurate was it, and how, in context of Egypt's larger history, how that fits into its narrative. So, again, it's a very difficult process to try to extrapolate from Herodotus, you know, this one fact, and then apply it to all of Egypt's history.
True. Now, of course, let's take a step back then. So at least there were Jewish slaves in Egypt, right? Well, again, not likely, or at least not as a people. I mean, as Gerard already stated, that in prehistorical times, or it's like when the pyramids were being built, Israel didn't exist, Judaism didn't exist, Hebrewism didn't exist. So almost by definition, there could not have been Jewish slaves then. But even after that, Israel and the Jewish people are only cursorily mentioned ever in any of the writings in Egypt. So they may have been slaves in the sense that, you know, one of the prizes of war is you get to take some people home with you as slaves. But slaves as a people seems to have absolutely no historical evidence at all.
That's right. There's zero evidence for an enslaved civilization in Egypt. Zero. And I mean, the Egyptians were pretty good at preserving history, and, you know, no evidence.
So what about the Exodus then? I mean, Passover means passing over from slavery to freedom. This is why the Exodus myth is so important to the Jewish culture. Without the Exodus, there would be no passing over. Again, there is no evidence outside of the Torah that this ever happened. You would think that if thousands of people left Egypt and thousands of people went through the Sinai for 40 years or even for less than that, there would be some evidence left. I mean, if only in contrast. So maybe the Egyptians didn't want to mention that they'd lost these people, but they would have said, you know, we've had to bring in the harvest this year and it was really hard because there were so few of us to do it. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But no, again, there was no mention of that. And as far as the plagues and all that goes, again, you'd think a lost generation would have been mentioned somewhere. So, you know, it does seem that the Passover and the Exodus itself is a convenient myth to help unify people to have that sort of origin story that everyone has. I mean, the Romans had Romulus and Remus, right? And they had the guy who left Troy. Who was it, Ethan? You know this. You're a historian.
Aeneas?
Yes, that's him. who, of course, you know, allowed Rome to get some claim to some great ancient heritage, which I imagine, you know, if you were, again, starting a new people, that would be important. One of the things, though, that I discovered when I was doing a little bit of research for this was the text itself. You know, one of the classic atheist sort of mentions is how cruel God is to Pharaoh. You know, Pharaoh says, let the people go, and then God hardens his heart, and he changes his mind just so God could torture him some more. But actually, you know, I went back, and of course, this depends on the translation. I actually used what I thought would be the worst-case scenario, the annotated skeptical Bible. And reading the text as presented there, actually, it seems that, like, you know, once God sort of let up on a plague, Pharaoh says, eh, screw it, I changed my mind, you can't go. And it's not quite as mean as it is often portrayed, especially by South Park, as one might think. I mean, I knew I always grew up with the idea that every time Pharaoh would let the Israelis go, according to the Jewish myth, then God would come in and say, no, no, I will harden your heart and you will have to suffer another plague. But that again, doesn't seem to be in the text.
Well, again, just kind of goes to show you how over time these stories get interpreted and translated, and you get these kind of strange narratives within the narrative, and that can really impact how it's interpreted over the years.
Yes. And speaking of interpreting things over the years, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about the new budget and how it can hurt us skeptics.
Stay tuned.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back. The new budget just announced by the Harper government will hit Canadians in several ways, thanks to the new word of the day, austerity. Austerity has failed in Ireland, failed in England, failed in Greece, Spain, and Portugal. So it seems we will try it here because, well, our government must technically be insane based on the definition that if you try something that has been done again and again with the same result, but you will do it and you'll get a different result, means, well, you must be insane. Seth Klein of the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives stated it best when he said none of these spending cuts are actually necessary. A balanced budget could be achieved in just 1 year later than what the current one targets without inflicting any damage. But I will suspend my usual rant whether we should be stimulating an economy during a recession, something all but the most ideological Friedmanites recommend. No, I will look at this in the way that these cuts could potentially impact the skeptical community. First, it is no secret that Harper personally and the conservative movement in general has always considered a corporate independent source of news unacceptable or at least uncomfortable. To the same, Harper has, and to be fair, Paul Martin, as the Liberal finance minister and leader before him as well, constantly attempted to undermine the financial base of the CBC. The CBC has gone from a completely publicly funded institution whose primary aim was to provide an independent source of news and to promote a uniquely Canadian culture to an emaciated shell of its former glory. As funding for the CBC was cut, the CBC has become more and more dependent on corporate advertising. It's not a coincidence that as politicians have attempted to starve the CBC out of existence, its ability to be both effective and independent from its advertisers has diminished. In a line from the famous Grover Norquist, I will paraphrase, Harper is attempting to shrink the CBC to a size where it can be drowned in the bathtub. The worst effect this has on the CBC is not even the reduced funding per se, but the unpredictability of such funding. Prior to the last election, Minister of Canadian Heritage, James Moore, stated, "We have said that we will maintain or increase support for the CBC. That is our platform, and we have said that before, and we will be committed to it in the future." Of course, now that they no longer have to deal with a minority in Parliament, this majority government doesn't care. Harper's Group has shown time and again that it doesn't give a heck about what the people want, what's best for Canada, only promoting their agenda. So why should we care? I did say I would be taking a skeptical view of this issue. Well, as Ethan has mentioned many times on the show before, his favorite CBC show, and I suspect perhaps one of his top 10 favorite shows of all time, is Marketplace. Marketplace has taken some very tough stands that annoy corporations. Now, as the CBC becomes more dependent on advertisers, there will be pressure put upon it that shows like this should not agitate its funding base. It's common operating practice for the CBC, Global News, and American shows, which don't have anything like Marketplace or The Nature of Things, because they know who pays the bills, and they jump to that master. There is more than independence angle here as well. The CBC will be shedding almost 700 jobs. These are people who do the interviews, the investigations around the world. I guess they will not be doing that soon. The CBC's ability to be a source of internationally independent, i.e. independent from other news agencies like Fox News or CNN, is being destroyed. Soon the CBC will be simply a retweeter of news from other agencies or worse. Lacking the manpower to produce news, they will rely on a common practice in the USA Now, and I suspect on our other more corporate news channels, where corporation press releases and faux news videos are broadcast as real news simply to fill in space and to cut down on cost. Loss of jobs also mean whole regions of this country will lose their CBC presence, notably the Maritimes this time after suffering similar event that decimated the CBC in the prairies because of the budget cuts. We are a large country, and one of the things that binds us together that creates a Canadian identity was the CBC. As more and more of our voices are silenced, regionalism will grow and will cease to be a culture but merely a warehouse repository for American raw goods. And of course, let's not forget the CBC's support for the Canadian arts. Regional programming like This Hour Has 22 Minutes, The Red Green Show, artists like The Bare Naked Lady, OLP, Nickelback, would never have really existed if it was not for the support they got from the CBC. Part of the problem is the reliability of funding. The CBC never knows what its budget will be year to year. The CBC must play politics to ensure or at least limit the losses that it's going to happen in the budget. We could adopt the funding scheme like they have in the UK for the BBC. In the UK, every household watching TV must actually pay a license. They pay about $230 a year. In Canada, we don't really have the cultural history, so I don't think a license would work here. But I mean, simply a guarantee of a certain percentage of tax revenue, something as small as 0.08% or some sort of surtax. This would allow the CBC not only to exist in the future, but to plan and to grow and to develop properly, because it would have a predictable source of income. It would also be free from both playing politics and being a target of politicians, which of course is one of the things that hurts its independence and its reliability as a news source. So again, why should we care as skeptics? As skeptics, we rely on factual information from a variety of reliable sources. As Canadians, we take pride in our culture. This is why we should care. Why we should remember that when the time comes to elect a Canadian government, we should do one that will support the CBC. How are we supposed to be able to distinguish woo science from real science if we have a source of news that is in the pockets of big pharma, big sugar, big whatever? It just feeds into that whole conspiracy-minded mentality.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the CBC, it really is sort of following in the early footsteps of, you know, national news. When the BBC first came out, you know, which the CBC is basically sort of modeled after, it was designed to sort of be this kind of go-to channel for all your news on politics and the way society was working. And in order to do that, it had to be independent. And you look at sort of the amazing work that went into the BBC, into the CBC, that work, that effort that made it such a reliable source of news was granted because it was independent of politics. It was independent of a ideology backing. It was just investigative journalism, and it also had that kind of cultural background that really gave it more, that made it more than just somebody sitting, you know, on a TV screen reading news off a teleprompter. It gave it some, you know, culture, a bit of backbone. And that was something that I think was just a staple for people growing up in Canada and growing up in the UK. So it's a really sort of sad and depressing thing to think that, you know, we're losing that really important aspect of our culture. And then, I mean, you mentioned how this is important to skeptics, and, you know, I totally agree. I mean, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we need to have independent but rationally focused news. And, you know, we've been bemoaning the state of news for a very long time, whether it's in newspapers or on the TV or wherever we're getting it. We've seen this encroaching of science reporting by things like blogs and podcasts because people have gotten so sick and tired of the spin from news media that they're turning to other sources now. So sadly, it looks like we're seeing the same thing happen when it comes to news sources like the CBC. So ultimately, we have to figure out a way to ensure that this institution can at least be preserved, but at the same time, improved upon. I mean, there's a certain silliness to the idea that we need the CBC to give us a Canadian identity. I mean, honestly, like, you look at what the CBC produces these days, and it's not all that stupendous. I mean, there's Hockey Night in Canada, and they show commercials for Viagra and Cold FX, which ironically Marketplace went to town on. But I mean, there's this kind of, I think, mistaken notion that the CBC is purely about sort of culture and Canadian identity, when I think more importantly, it's the sort of rational, independent aspect of the CBC that makes it so vitally important to Canada's future. So I think the difficult aspect here for skeptics is, you know, what are we supposed to do about this? And when you have an institution like the CBC that is dependent on politics, well, then we have to make sure that we're skeptical voters and that when we go to the election and, you know, elect our government and our policies, we need to keep our skepticism close to our heart, as well as our opinions on, you know, humanism and secular values as well. So, again, just another instance where we need to make sure that we're not just skeptics when it comes to Bigfoot and homeopathy, but we're skeptics when it comes to everything.
You know, and that plays into the how do we put this? You mentioned that CBC doesn't have much to do with our culture, and part of that, I think, is because you grew up too late. I mean, the damage that's been done to the CBC has been a long, ongoing event to the point now where it no longer has enough funds to have, quote-unquote, decent or commercially successful cultural shows. But it also needs to push back, and you're right, to focus on sort of the news and the educational aspects. I mean, if you take a look at the quote-unquote other educational channels, like the Discovery Channel, where it's got things like the Auction Kings and American Chopper, American Logger. I mean, outside the fact they're all American, that's a whole other thing. And the Learning Channel. And I mean, I won't even get into the Learning Channel and how unlearning the Learning Channel is. We do need this alternative source, an independent source that will be independent of, like I say, the corporate people who want either A, to promote their products, which is the gross sort of form of it. But the other thing is just the whole idea of dumbing down society. I mean, it's easy to see why people might want to go to something that is, quote unquote, adrenaline packed and has lots of flash and pizzazz, but either no science or little science. I mean, how many times have we bemoaned the fact that Ghost Hunters is a big show on TV? When they don't, it is so antithetical to what we think of. So not only are they on there, but they downgrade the tone of the conversation you have with other people because they think that is what real science is, and it's not. And that's where the CBC has its thing. And it's something we need to remember that when we do go vote in the next election, that this becomes an important issue for us skeptics because we see that this will interact with a lot more other issues. I mean, when we talk about things like environmentalism, religion in schools, healthcare, regulations, how do we form our opinions on this is based upon what we learn and we know, and we need to learn and know things from a truly independent and factually based source. And the only one we have any real control over is the CBC, and that's where we should be putting our eggs into a basket this Easter.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the only saving grace that I see about this sort of thing is this ongoing trend to sort of reject mainstream commercialized media. And that sort of makes me sound like a bit of a crank, but I actually think that we're getting a lot more in terms of science and in terms of just sort of critical thinking on things like Facebook and Wikipedia than we are on CNN or BBC or even the CBC. And that's a very strange phenomenon. I mean, this is the first time in human history that we've had this kind of revolution of information. I mean, I remember not having Wikipedia, and it's so strange to look back and not have Wikipedia. So, I mean, sure, we may see some networks go down the drain, and some of them, you know, like you say, you know, knowledge network and such, good riddance, you're not really doing a good job anyway. And in some cases, it's pretty sad to see the CBC sort of, you know, lose its oomph. But at the same time, it makes us want to invest even more in the really cool and somewhat better replacements that we have online, whether it's things like Wikipedia or even like Twitter that's able to send us news updates from around the world. We have to find ways to replace what we're losing. But if we're lucky, we can find better replacements out there as well, which is a great way to, which I think is a great for our community, because skeptics are so innovative from the beginning. I mean, we're finding such really cool things out there. I mean, like, we're building communities online. We're connecting people all the way around the world. We're having really important conversations, and many of these conversations are happening without even actually seeing each other, and that's pretty incredible. So, while it's too bad to see some of these networks go, I mean, it's not the end of the world for us. We're just going to have to adapt. It's a shame, but like I said, I mean, our movement is too powerful to be stopped by losing the CBC.
I am skeptic. Hear me roar.
Absolutely.
When we come back, we're going to talk about another aspect of the budget that will diminish our ability to advocate for political issues.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. You can also listen to the show by subscribing to iTunes. And I hope you enjoy your skeptical discussions and debate.
And we're back. So, again, in the budget, there's an attack on political advocacy. The Harper government is attempting to pressure environmental groups to stop bothering conservative donors like Big Oil. Well, okay, maybe it's a bit too pointed. However, one of the aspects of the government, well, politicians, and they are people, they can be a bit vindictive. The recent success, although partly thwarted, of the environmental mobilization of groups to stop or at least slow down the Keystone Pipeline in the U.S. and the Northern Gateway Pipeline in northern B.C. has made the government a little, well, bitchy. In January, Natural Resource Minister Joe Oliver issued a public letter or diatribe denouncing, quote, environmentalists and other radical groups who, quote, hijacked regulatory bodies and, this is the important part, used funding from foreign special interest groups to undermine Canada's national economic interest. So as part of the new budget, they are trying to limit, quote, foreign interference in Canadian politics by ramping up a crackdown on charities that do too much political advocacy. According to Canada's charity laws, and I didn't know this, but charities can only dedicate 10% of its resources to political advocacy. There are exceptions made for sort of unique events, and I quote, for example, an environmental conservative charity may decide to mobilize public support in favor of an international environmental treaty by taking out a full-page advertisement in a national newspaper, thereby devoting more than 10% of its total resources that year to political activities. Because it reasonably considers that to ratify the treaty would help its charity achieve its goals. So this sort of one-time thing is sort of allowed, but overall you're not allowed to exceed this sort of 10% limit. So this budget includes, in spite of the austerity, an additional $8 million for Revenue Canada to ensure that charities are upholding this only 10% political advocacy limit. A lot of this money is actually going to be used to perform audits, which are not only costly to the taxpayer, because the government side of it, but they're also a burden on the charity, which must pay for its end of the audit, not to mention take up its time doing the audit instead of doing what charity should be doing, helping the community. I don't think I would mind this so much if it didn't seem like such cheap politics. But then again, maybe it's not cheap politics, but political opportunism. The public knows that this is petty, but not part of some grand scheme to weaken our regulatory defenses. Or is it? They are also eliminating the National Roundtable on Environment and the Economy, originally established in the 1990s to advise prime ministers about environmental issues. And they've regularly come out with things that sort of challenge the business and environmental policies of governments, in particular areas of climate change. And we all know how much the Harper government doesn't think climate change is real. Couple that with the absence of federal criticism or even acknowledgement of the millions of dollars corporations are spending to promote their industries. So they're criticizing environmental groups that are advocating against things like the pipeline. Well, they're continuing to allow and actually supporting through subsidies the companies that are trying to push through these pipelines. It's kind of a one-sided sort of thing. When the government goes to a treaty, for example, they often will bring an industry lobbyist, most notably during recent talks to limit the arms trade in troubled regions of the world. Instead of trying to help the poor, we brought a gun lobbyist. And coincidentally, we also said that we're going to suspend ourselves and try and get an amendment so that hunting and sporting guns wouldn't be regulated. And I'm sure there's no foreign influence involved there at all, even though most gun manufacturers are foreign owned. So again, why should we as skeptics care? We often will accuse the less skeptic type of creating boogeymen where there is none, that there is no great conspiracy to take over the world, to pollute our water, or to kill our children. To make this claim, we must have relative confidence in our regulatory system and the machinery of democracy. If the only people allowed to talk in a democracy are the megacorps, the only ones providing funding to research, we no longer have that certainty that there may not actually be something in the water. We may not be able certain that our politicians are not mostly working for us. We may not be certain that when the government says this is safe or there's no risk to the environment, that we can trust them, or even that they need worry about being truthful. There's gone the checks and balances. If this machinery for the public to question government, to challenge the power of the corporations, if this machinery is reduced or lost, we all lose. The change being made to attack environmental groups will not help skepticism, but merely fuel a new generation of conspiracy-minded fanatics. And sadly, we may not be able to honestly say that they're wrong, lacking the information and the availability to push back against the government, the corporations, and the science that they're going to promote. And we've seen so many times, especially in things like climate scientists, industry is quite willing to fuzz science in order to promote their own agenda. And if there isn't a force to push back on that, it is easy to slip into this sort of conspiracy-minded mentality. And once we slip into it for things that are sort of semi-legitimate, we fall into things that are not legitimate, like I mentioned last time about Wi-Fi.
It's actually kind of interesting because this is not necessarily the perfect weapon for the current government, because this could easily turn around and bite them pretty badly. If Revenues Canada starts to investigate charities that are being more than 10% political, a perfect place to start will be all the religious charities that are devoting all their energy to helping get conservatives elected to government. And there's a lot of them. So this could actually turn around and really reduce their power to help get conservatives elected. So this is a really double-edged sword for the Conservative Party if they think this is going to help them take a bite out of the environment movement. I could see this turning around and taking a big bite out of the evangelical movement that is really, really stepping way beyond 10% political activism here.
No, and you're right. You know, I worry, of course, that they will apply the law in a less than fair manner. But you draw a very good point that actually, if you know, we go down to brass tacks, we get things like religious groups advocating for curriculums in school, which can be considered to be forms of political activism. They're wanting to promote, you know, either anti-abortion laws or government funding of schools, like in Ontario. How could they have possibly not passed the 10% limit in the recent budget? I don't know.
Absolutely. So I mean, that'll be an interesting thing to see. And again, it's one of those things we really have to take our skepticism with us when we go into to an election. So hopefully the next time around, more Canadians will be a bit more skeptical when it comes time to cast their ballot.
Yes. And just to round out some of the other cuts that are in there, which again affect us as skeptics because it clouds our ability to find the truth so as to promote the truth. Health Canada is going to lose over 840 positions thanks to $300 million in cuts. I mentioned last week about how the Canadian Food Inspection Agency is giving up the inspection part of its job title and leaving that up to you and me to police the ingredient list and nutritional claims on labeling. And Public Safety Canada is experiencing the second largest cuts after defense of almost $1 billion. I mean, safety, health, food. These are the hot button issues that the crack skeptic community jump on. And all honesty, after cuts like this, it becomes much harder for us to provide a source of rational pushback so that we can, again, pick the right battles to fight. So when it comes to the next election, please put your skepticism first and vote for something that's going to be good for the country and not necessarily bad for the country. When we come back from our break, we're going to have some skeptical highlights.
The East Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So we're out of time for today's show, so we'll be going to our skeptical highlights. I have one here. It is an event by CFI Vancouver. They're presenting a debate, Dying with Dignity, featuring Wanda Morris, Executive Director of the Dying with Dignity Foundation. And in opposition to the notion of dying with dignity is Dr. Will Johnson, Chair of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition of BC. The event is taking place Thursday, April 12th, 7 p.m. at the Fletcher Theater at Harbor Center, Simon Fraser University. So go on and check that out. Looks like a very good debate and should be a really good discussion after that as well.
You know, this is one of those cases, I think, where there's a lot to be said in the name. I mean, dying with dignity. I mean, how can you be against dying with dignity? Whereas Euthanasia Prevention Coalition sounds like some sort of, you know, don't get pregnant sort of group. And I mean, I'm sure they're both going to have very good arguments to bring to the floor. And I hope it's a very lively and good debate. But again, title, a lot to do with how successful you come across, I think. You think?
It's possible, yeah. We'll see.
So my skeptical highlights, I've got two this week and both of them online. StatsCan, which also experienced budget cuts, and remember they got rid of the census, because so now we no longer really know how truthful or accurate information is. But besides that, in February, Statistics Canada has made access to most of its data free. Previously, a lot of their stuff you had to pay like a $3 charge plus tax, and that could get quite expensive if you're doing something like trying to figure out what's the real job rates in Canada per province. So anyhow, the site's opened up called CanSim, where you can find your data. There's some tutorials on how to use it. So it allows you to break out your inner geek or your outer cynic, whichever way you want to head. We'll have that on our website. Another website that you can check out is the food ingredients that are most prone to fraud and adulteration. Now that the government has abdicated its responsibility for policing food labeling, I found this site may help you. It's a database created by the U.S. Pharmacopeia Convention, USP, a nonprofit science organization that develops standards to help ensure the identity, quality, and purity of food, the ingredients, supplements, and pharmaceuticals. They've created something called the Food Chemical Codex Compendium, which is a database that provides information and baseline information to help interested parties like you and me to assess the risks of finding something that's not supposed to be in our particular products. They have over 1,300 records, most of them from scholars, although some from public and media. In fact, the vast majority of them are actually academic-type resources, about 1,000 of the 1,300. And like I say, it's the type of thing that if on the label it says vegetable oil, and scientists actually have done tests inadvertently or however, and they've discovered actually in this was something like animal fats or something like that. It's a good place just to find out, are they being accurate, and to check out the labeling versus what you're actually getting. That's about all I've got this week, Ethan.
Seems to be it for Radio Freethinker for this week. So this is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Rising of the Milky Way, the cosmos is full.